This is a download from the BBC. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
The European Union policy of encouraging plant fuels for cars has been condemned as unethical by a leading independent research organisation. The Nuffield Council on Bioethics says biofuels are damaging the environment and pushing up food prices.
African biofuels destined for Europe will result in up to 6 times the carbon emissions of fossil fuels. That's according to a report commissioned by the RSPB, ActionAid and Nature Kenya. The report focuses on the Dakacha woodlands in Kenya, which are set to be destroyed to make way for Jatropha plantations.
Biofuels were hailed as the environmental solution to fossil fuels not that long ago. Made from living crops, they take up carbon dioxide as they grow, so burning them shouldn't disturb the balance of warming gases in the atmosphere. But for the last few years, the publicity about biofuels has been mainly negative. And for good reason. Biofuels are made from energy crops like oil palm, which have been grown in place of food crops or rainforests. In some cases, using these crops actually produces more CO2 than burning fossil fuels. But biofuels refuse to die. Ian O'Gara looks after bioenergy for the consultancy firm Accenture.
The global fuel market is what's about 2 trillion litres. Global biofuels is probably around 75 billion at this point in time. We've got a long way to go. In the European Union, we've got about a 5% incorporation rate across member states. In the US, it's about 10% for the passenger vehicle fleet. Longer term, the IEA, the International Energy Agency, have came out with their World Energy Outlook at the end of last year, and they said that by 2035, they expect biofuels to probably increase from current levels about fourfold by 2035, and that we would be looking at probably biofuels accounting for about 40% of transport fuels in Brazil, I think around sort of 25% in the US and about 17% in the EU.
So our vehicles run on 5% biofuel. Despite calls for this quota to be axed, biofuel research is alive and well. At some point in the future, oil reserves will run out and we will need to have liquid alternatives to conventional petrol and diesel if we want to travel in vehicles like the ones we have today. In this edition of Frontiers, I'll be meeting the researchers who are finding new sources of biofuels. It's a story of two unlikely heroes, algae and bacteria, and the quest to speed up a process that naturally takes millions of years. At Cambridge University, Professor Alison Smith's long-held fascination with algae is paying off. Algae come in all shapes and sizes, from macroalgae, or rather seaweed, that we'll look at later, to microalgae that can be less than 1 millimetre in diameter.
For many hundreds of years, humans have been exploiting seaweed, both for food but also fuel, perhaps burning it and so on. But now we are turning to the idea of using it to make more sophisticated fuels like diesel.
So what you're doing essentially is replicating a process that occurred millions of years ago when the ancient algae was compressed by perhaps tectonic forces and produced this crude oil that we now reap the benefits of today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that our whole economy is based now on fossil fuels and oil and so on. And we've learnt how to exploit that material in a way which has enabled our civilization to advance. The problem is that the reserves that are there, there's one estimate that suggests that we're using up 1 million years worth of fossil fuel every year. So we've only got a limited amount. Whilst we've still got lots of reserves at the moment, it's not going to last forever.
So what you're going to do is essentially speed up that process and use algae that's growing today so that it can be replaced.
Exactly. So rather than going through the fossilisation process, grow algae and then extract the fuel directly from them and use it.
What makes algae great from an environmental stance is that many of them photosynthesise. In other words, they take in carbon dioxide, make sugars and give off oxygen. To get biodiesel, Alison Smith has to persuade her algae to first make oil, fats in other words.
Well, algae don't produce them normally because they're, the microalgae, because they're basically single cells and all they want to do is grow and divide. So they don't really need storage molecules, which are what the lipids are. However, if you treat them in a particular way, actually they can experience them in their natural conditions. If there are low nutrients around, then they can still photosynthesize, but they don't know what to do with the fixed carbon, so they can turn that into lipid. So in the laboratory or in an industrial context, that's what people do. They grow the algae under these conditions and then they produce lipids. Now, the problem with that is that there's a trade-off. If you reduce the nutrients, then the algae don't grow. So people are very interested in trying to find out how to, if you like, fool the algae so that they will still grow and make the lipids and make the fats.
Well, your lab is absolutely chock-a-block full of glasses of this algae, of all different colours, of all these different liquids of different sizes. I can see here, just swirling next to me, a whole tray of algae.
They're just growing in there.
They're just growing.
That's where we grow them. You need to shake them like this in order to get the CO2 in and the oxygen out.
Oh, and they're so small, such tiny little samples.
Well, we don't need large ones. We don't need the thousands of hectares to do our experiments because we're interested in the molecules inside the algae. So we just do them on a small scale. But as you've said, there are lots of them all around. So the different types are because algae are very diverse. So what's true of one alga is not necessarily true of another. So we're studying different aspects of them.
So eventually the idea is to scale this tiny little jar up.
Yes.
Into a full-size pond or curtained-off bit of ocean to grow the biodiesel.
That's right.
For our fuel.
Yeah.
So if I wanted to get a litre of fuel, I mean, how much land will it need?
Well, roughly sort of 50 to 100 litres could be produced per hectare per day.
So it's not actually inconceivable that we could produce enough.
So a playing field, you know, out the back of your house would be able to produce a reasonable amount of diesel for you to drive your car backwards and forwards to school or whatever.
If only I had a garden the size of a playing field. I would cover it in algae.
Alison Smith says algae could also be cultivated on roofs or on tubes on the sides of buildings or on marginal lands. It wouldn't need to replace food crops on arable land, but grown at a large scale, it would visibly change the countryside. But this is a crop that doesn't even need land. It could be grown in existing watercourses. And that's what researchers at Queen's University Belfast are doing on Strangford Loch, a sea loch on the east coast of Northern Ireland. Professor Matthew Dring and his team are trying to improve the productivity of their local species of macroalgae, kelp. Compared with land plants that we've been cultivating and improving for millennia, the seaweed are not at all simple.
We want to cultivate, and clearly there are advantages in cultivating seaweeds for energy purposes, so we can leave the natural stocks and the natural ecosystems untouched. The kelps have a slightly complicated life history in that the spores that are produced by the large kelp plants do not germinate to produce another kelp plant. What they do is germinate to produce a microscopic phase in their life history, which is a branch filamentous microscopic phase that normally grows just on the surface of stones. They are male and female, and when they become fertile, the females produce eggs, the males produce sperm, and sperm fertilise the eggs, and then we get the new kelp plant. So what we aim to do is, since it's very difficult to control this in natural conditions or in seawater indeed, what we aim to do is to get through that phase of the life history in a hatchery.
Dr. Karen Mooney, who manages the Unalgae project, shows me the kelp hatchery kept at a chilly 10 degrees Celsius.
So if I open this red glazed door here,
yep,
I can see these big jars with, what they look like tiny little bubbling dots, really, specks.
Yes.
Can you tell me what that is?
Yes, well, they're about 5 litre flasks, all conical flasks. So with them, there's water bubbling through, and the seaweed spores themselves, I call them spores just for ease, but they're small black balls of these little tiny plants that all just kind of clump together, and we keep them growing in this. We give them a nutrient media, and we give them a fresh supply of air, and then the air that's bubbling through keeps them moving as well. So it's the same conditions as they would be if they were out in the loch in the natural environment. And we keep them in the red light right up until we need to get them to go into the fertile stage. And that's when we transfer them over to the blue light in the bottom.
So if I open this blue door, This blue light is letting the right sort of light in for the fertile stage to be triggered.
Yes, this blue light is pretty much the same as white light, so what they would be exposed to naturally. And that's just the same as if we were to let them be exposed to natural conditions out in the water. So whenever we transfer them over, it stops the vegetative stage and allows them to then become fertile, and the male and female gametes can then fertilise each other. And then that's whenever we get our small plants that we're able to put on our strings.
That string comes from South Korea, a country with a long tradition of growing seaweed for food. On the other side of the hatchery, Karen Mooney grows the kelps in water baths until they're big enough to go back into the loch. She takes me out on a boat to look at her floating forests.
So we're in a lovely sheltered spot here, and it looks like a kind of wet snooker table with just white balls.
Yes, that's actually pretty much it, yeah. The site that we're in is roughly just over 7 hectares, but we're actually only have lines in one corner of it, which takes up just under 1 hectare. We've got 6 long lines in it at the moment, and each long line has got a series of white buoys along the top, spaced every 10 metres.
Yeah, I can see it, like a necklace. And this one, it's like a curtain of seaweed hanging down. It's growing really well.
Yes, yeah. Whenever we seed the lines, so we have our string that we've taken from the hatchery, and we wrap it around the rope, and the seaweed just basically grows continually the whole way down the line. You do get a little bit of grazing on it sometimes, and particularly in this area of the loch, some of the sites can get quite shallow when the tide drops very low, so we do get a little bit of erosion on some parts. But for the next deployment season that we have, we're going to move them just a little bit further into the middle part, so they're a little bit deeper.
Well, it looks really successful. Are you happy with this?
Especially considering the winter that we've had, the site is a lot more exposed than it would normally be. Where we are, there's a band of land that goes around, and usually the wind comes from over the land, and it's not going to be as strong. But with the winter, obviously, we've had the beast from the east and the northerly winds coming in, so it's been a lot more exposed than it would normally be. And so far, between that and the rubbish light, the seaweed has actually grown really well, so we're quite optimistic for the potential for it to grow in the future. On 2 lines here, we're growing one of our species, Laminaria, and the other 2 lines here, it's another species, which is the Saccharina. And then on the other 2 sides, they're more experimental, so we're growing seaweeds that we have seeded in different methods and different time trials of whenever the best time is to actually put the seaweed out. And they're actually all growing really well as well, so we're quite happy.
And if you were to choose one of these types of seaweed to grow for a biofuel, which one would you go for?
The one that we would probably go for at the moment is the Saccharina, just because it's growing a lot quicker and it's a lot faster. If you wanted, you could stagger the growth, and you could maybe put some Saccharina out first and put Laminaria out later, and then that means you're going to extend your growth period, because obviously it's still seasonal. So at the moment we're only getting 1 large harvest each year, but if you can split that into the 2 species and then optimise the different life cycles that they've got and the different periods of whenever you get best growth, then you might be able to split it into 2 larger harvests. But it's something that we're still in very early stages of looking at.
And there's a good few metres between each of your lines here. Is that done intentionally?
Between each line, we've got 10 metres. We've done it because, especially in this area with the tidal range, the lines can go quite slack, so they can kind of move quite close together. So we have them at 10 metres apart, so there's minimal chance of that happening. And then also we want to be able to make sure the boat can get in between the lines as well for whenever we go to harvest and to deploy our seaweed.
But if you were to scale this up and to do it in a proper production facility, surely it would be more efficient to have tighter lines.
It would be efficient to have more tight lines. There's a limit as to how tight you could go, because you will need to get a boat in past them. People are looking at other methods of deployment. There's a group thinking about deploying seaweed in the Isle of Man, and they're looking at bundling about 5 lines together and growing them all together. It just depends really on the facilities that you have at the moment. This is still a pilot scale, so we are looking at different methods to try and improve the use of the site that we've got, but that all depends on the boat's facilities that you have and how you're going to harvest them as well.
Essentially, we're at the beginning of seaweed cultivation, so it's equivalent perhaps to what was going on in Mesopotamia in, 3,000 years BC, when we first found wheat and started to develop wheat and select and breed it from that. And we're just beginning at that stage. We now have genetic techniques, so we may be able to do it more quickly than the Mesopotamians could, but we're still at the initial stage.
So how does Matthew Dring think that macroalgae could be used to produce energy or fuel a car?
One way we can get energy out of the seaweed is to ferment to produce ethanol and alcohol. That depends on having nice available sugars, which are produced by some seaweeds at particular times. But a more general use, a general way of extracting the energy is through what's called anaerobic digestion, where you're digesting the seaweed in non-aerobic, in the absence of oxygen. And this will produce methane as a gas, which can then be used and liquefied and used either as a fuel, and I think this may be one advantage, it is a potential fuel for transport, or of course can be used to generate electricity.
So seaweed grows under the water, not taking up that valuable food crop space on land that, say, maize or sugarcane does. But how does it compare in terms of productivity, in terms of how much fuel you can get from the same acreage?
Productivity of subtidal kelps is reckoned to be extremely high, is reckoned to be comparable with that of tropical rainforests. So it is producing a lot of energy, the productivity is extremely high, so that there is the potential there for generating a lot of energy.
So in the future, there may be cultivated kelp forests around our shores. One idea is to place them around the bases of offshore wind farms, which might help prevent them interfering with navigation. So far, the algae researchers we've heard from have been trying to make fuel by growing their crops as they do naturally, in sunlight and carbon dioxide. A company called Solarzyme, based in San Francisco, has taken a different approach, and its biofuels have already flown a plane and been sold to car drivers.
So the car we're driving today is a VW Passat. It's a brand new car with a brand new engine. There's nothing different about it. The main difference you'll see, other than the stickers on the outside of the car, are that we are fueled with 100% algal fuel here. And this car has been running, I see it's got 9,500 miles on it. So absolutely no problems with it. VW's collecting telemetry as we sit here, and we'll be monitoring, you know, how fast can I accelerate, plenty of power, no changes to the normal operation.
That's Graham Ellis, Vice President for Business and Development at Solarzyme. In its research facility, he explains how the company produces diesel from algae.
So you should think of it that we are processing sunlight indirectly. So if you look at what algae do, and if you look at the ones in the pond, they will take some light, they'll convert it to sugars in their bodies, and then they'll convert the sugars to oil. So it's a two-step process. Unfortunately, they're not very good at converting it to sugars, and so the fundamental thing is that natural algae make about 10-15% oil in their bodies. So what we said, let's just split it apart. Sugarcane, fantastic at capturing light and turning it into sugar. Algae, fantastic at taking sugar and turning it into oil. So we split the two apart, we feed the sugar direct to the algae, and we get huge improvements. So our algae have like 85% oil inside them. So it's a totally different concept, but it really gets much more efficient than you would be outside in a pond or with wild algae. If you kind of peep into this particular fermenter, if we were able to pull that out, there'd be tiny little sort of micron-sized algae happily feeding away on the sugar, and there are literally going to be millions of them in there. So it's like a light-coloured flower, just like yellowy touch. Over here on this side of the apparatus, you've got the various vitamins coming through, and this computer in the centre here is monitoring what are they eating, how much of it are they eating, and feeding them exactly what they want. They get to sit around for just a few days before they are then dried and the oil's taken out of them.
This approach to making fuels means using sugar, a fuel crop. In Brazil, where biofuels have really taken off, cars have been tuned to run on bioethanol made from sugar. But the advantage of using algae is that you can get a biofuel that's tailored to be just like the diesel from crude oil. And that means you don't have to change the vehicle at all. Graham Ellis says that Solarzyme is ready to use non-food crops to fuel their algae.
Now, I can make this anywhere where I get large-scale carbohydrates. And today there are probably 2, 3, 4 sources of those. You've got sugarcane in Brazil, which, as you're probably aware, is one of the most sustainable forms of growth of biomass and so on. That's why the Brazilians are exporting so much ethanol. You have corn in the United States. And then thirdly, we're one of the leaders in using cellulosic sugars. So the future actually is occurring in this lab around you. So cellulosic sugars, meaning coming from wood, from stover. A fair proportion of the plant contains usable sugars. The trick is always how to get them out. So we have various partners around the United States and the rest of the world who are investigating how to get the sugars. Once they get the sugars, we can turn them into something that the world needs.
Manchester University's Institute for Biotechnology is one place where researchers are looking at ways of harvesting the sugars from waste plant materials, such as the parts of cereals that we don't eat, and lignin from wood.
My name's Mark Corbett and I'm a postdoctoral researcher in the group. My project is to look at the breakdown of lignin into liquid transport biofuels. So lignin is a huge problem as a waste product at the moment, and if we can utilise that resource to make biofuels, then we're taking something that's a very low value and actually causes problems in for lots of other industries, and turning that into a really useful product.
My name's Lucy Heap. I'm a third year PhD student coming to the end of my studies. My research project is focused on lignin degradation. So in particular, we're looking at enzymes that can degrade lignin. Lignin's quite inhibitory to the production of bioethanol. So we're looking at greener methods to remove lignin as opposed to some of the harsher, more toxic ones. I'm using an enzyme called lacase and kind of exploring the different reactions of the enzyme and then working with some real lignocellulosic substrates from biomass, such as wheat straw and corn and sorghum stover. Some promising results.
As well as this research, the team under Professor of Chemical Biology, Nick Turner, is using bacteria to make biofuels. Professor Turner is using synthetic biology to genetically engineer the bacterium E. coli to churn out biodiesel.
The idea of taking genes which code for proteins from other organisms and putting them in E. coli, getting them to work in an efficient manner, that's synthetic biology. And that now is easier to do than it was 10 years ago. You know, sometimes it's as simple as reading the literature and somebody has found an enzyme that does something or a gene that does something interesting, and then the question is, would it work on the particular feedstock you're interested in? Another approach which is becoming hugely powerful is bioinformatics. So you now look at gene sequences, and based on the sequence of the gene, you maybe don't know exactly what the protein does, but you use comparative sequences to sort of try and get some insight into what this new gene sequence can do. And this all relates to the fact that you can sequence a microbial genome now in a few days. And then we have this whole basket of technologies which allows us to improve enzymes using sort of the principles of Darwinian evolution, which again is massively powerful. So we don't just rely on natural genes or proteins. We take them out of the environment, get them into the lab and start to work on them.
Nick Turner's team have fed oils or lipids to the bacteria to make alkanes, which are the chemical chains found in fossil fuels, as has Professor John Love at Exeter University.
We would take these fats and convert them directly to alkanes. That way we don't have any processing, if you like, or processing costs on the chemicals. Essentially what's happening is the bacteria is acting like its own little chemical factory and is producing the alkanes directly. It took around about 9 genes all acting together in order to produce this pathway, and we sort of synthetically engineered the bacterium to do that.
So instead of taking oil from the ground and putting it through a refinery and processing facility in a big factory, you're taking these tiny bacterium cells and you're genetically manipulating it to carry out that chemistry for you inside the cell.
That's absolutely correct, yes.
And just 9 genes you needed.
Well, just 9 genes is an awful lot, actually. It's quite difficult to get genes to all work together in concert, if you like. And bacteria are very, very good at that. They've evolved very efficient ways of making their genes work for them. And that's why they can be quite dangerous in terms of pathogens and things like that. And what we're trying to do here is to fix these pathways in the bacteria and also build in the safeguards using synthetic biology to ensure that should there be a spill or something like that, then these bacteria would not represent a danger either to an environment or to human health.
But bacteria like E. coli don't photosynthesize. They don't get their energy from the sun.
That's
they
correct,
need
yes.
to eat sugars in order to mm-hmm. produce this. And their food could be our food. So are we running into exactly the same problem?
Yes, initially that will be the case. Our bacteria do require sugar in order to process to fat, in order to make the fuel. But the advantage of bacteria, again, is that they're quite happy to eat a lot of different things, things that we would not normally be able to eat. So they can eat alternative sugars that come from, say, waste wood or waste paper or the corn stover that's left over in fields. So we would eat the grain, and all the leftover part, the straw and things like that, could be used to feed the bacteria. The other advantage as well is that you can not only engineer the output pathway to produce the fuel, but you can also synthetically engineer the input pathway so that the bacteria can eat things that we would consider to be waste products. So you could even start conceiving of them feeding off of things like sewage sludge and things like that, for which there isn't really a dearth of, then you could really use this to recycle appropriately waste into a product that we need a lot of and quite badly.
In the future, we could see bioreactors connected to sewage plants generating fuels for our cars and planes. Or we could nurture our own algal ponds in our gardens. There's no shortage of ideas about how we could generate our fuel. But in the short term, as Nick Turner reminds us, we're in the hands of Big Oil, who are funding some of this synthetic biology research, and who, importantly, have the means and experience in distributing all fuels.
The people who are ultimately going to take this technology to market have to be the oil companies. What is happening at the moment is there is a huge global effort in terms of developing new technologies, demonstrating that they work at lab scale, pilot scale, and then they might sit there and wait. They won't be taken to full sort of commercial application unless there is clearly a commercial payback. So what everybody will tell you is the oil companies are trying to work out what their best options are. They obviously explore alternative options, shale gas, oil shales. They constantly find new oil reserves, which is really their core business. So they're very interested in biofuels, but they have to be the people who run with this technology.
So if we are to replace fossil fuels with biofuels, getting algae and bacteria to produce a good alternative is just a first step. If these novel biofuels are to become more than just a lab quirk, it's going to mean installing new infrastructure, distribution and production. This will need concerted effort from governments, from vehicle and aviation industries, not least from the oil giants, as well as from drivers like you and me.
If you've enjoyed this programme, you might like to try other Radio 4 podcasts, including Start the Week, lively discussions chaired by Andrew Marr, and a weekly highlight from Radio 4's evening arts programme, Front Row. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.